The second paper then on this morning's program is entitled Some Grazing Occultation Experiences of the Niagara Falls Center by Mr. G.R. Winder of the Niagara Falls Center. This paper will be read by Mr. Robert Doran, President of the Niagara Falls Center.
Some Grazing Occultation Experiences of the Niagara Falls Center of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada by G.R. Winder. Several years ago, I was innocently leafing through the latest issue of Sky and Telescope when I stumbled into David Dunham's article about grazing occultations. My memories of this incident are somewhat fogged by the passage of time, but I seem to recall reading that a grazing occultation is similar to an ordinary occultation in which the moon, because of its orbital motion, passes between us and a star. Because most stars have very small angular diameters, and because the moon has no significant atmosphere, a star will seem to disappear instantaneously when covered by the edge of the moon. Sometime later, the star will reappear at the other edge of the moon. If we wish to observe a grazing occultation, affectionately referred to as a graze, we move to a position on the Earth's surface where we will see the moon's edge just briefly touch the star or graze it. Such a location can be calculated rather laboriously by hand, but it is now determined usually by computer. In fact, a graze can be observed from any point on a line on the Earth's surface, just as a total solar eclipse can be observed from any position within a path. Now, the interesting features of a graze are revealed when we realize that the profile of the moon's edge is not smooth, but generally rugged and mountainous. Hence, many disappearances of a star behind mountains, together with the subsequent reappearances, might be seen during the brief moments of a single graze. Disappearances and reappearances are collectively referred to as events. Well, David Dunham's article contained a small map of the United States, and this map was strewn with graze paths. Since one appeared to cross the Niagara Peninsula, I became curious to observe a graze, and you know what they say about curiosity. In my letter to David Dunham, I asked for the exact location of the graze path. In due time, I received a surprising amount of literature with detailed instructions for plotting graze paths and timing the events. Undaunted by the massive pressures of schoolwork, I forged through some of this, borrowed a large-scale topographic map of the area from the high school geography department, carefully plotted the graze path from David Dunham's predictions, organized an expedition of interested members of the Niagara Falls Center, and watched it rain on the night of the graze. Our next attempt to observe a graze came several months later on May 26, 1966, for the star 42 Leonis. Hugh McLean, Joe Hauser, a student member and his father, and I drove to the outskirts of Bismarck, Ontario, a convenient spot on the plotted graze path. On the way to the site, the student's father stopped our caravan and expressed concern that we would not arrive at our destination in time. This incident points out the need for detailed and precise planning for these outings. In this case, the father was driving on daylight saving time, while we experienced amateur astronomers were operating on standard time. We set up our telescopes in a schoolyard close to number 20 highway. We were planning to time the events by using a tape recorder and a shortwave radio. Theoretically, the tape recorder simultaneously records the time signals from the radio and the exuberant shouts of the observers as they see the events. It is easy to see that a person can find the times of the events by playing back the tape. In addition, the recorder often picks up some interesting comments. As the time for the graze drew near, a slight haze crept over the moon. 42 Leonis was still visible in my 6-inch reflector, which is generally considered to be of somewhat rustic construction, but the other two telescopes present would not show it. I was gloating for several minutes as I watched the star until I realized that the moon had missed it. For some reason, the graze path had not been plotted correctly. The fault was probably mine because the student had volunteered to plot the path and I had neglected to give him some important details. For example, I should have mentioned that the path must be plotted with a high degree of accuracy. My method of obtaining this accuracy is to convert units of latitude and longitude into centimeters by measuring with a rule the distance between several minute marks on the edges of the map. If I measure X minutes as equivalent to Y centimeters, then there are X over Y minutes per centimeter and Y over X centimeters per minute. By measuring distances on a large-scale topographic map with an accurate rule, I can achieve an accuracy of 100 feet or better in the position of the path. It is also very important to carefully measure the positions of the observers, thus ensuring that the results will be of use to professional astronomers. Another detail concerns the position of the occulted star. The uncertainty in the declination of the star is stated on the computer sheets and should be considered when the path is plotted. Because the predictions are given for the mean or average limb of the moon, a profile plot should be used to determine the most favorable points of observation. A profile plot is a map of the profile of the limb of the moon and can be quite different from the mean limb. Also, there is a mysterious southward shift of the graze paths for northern limit grazes. This interesting fact was discovered by other graze expeditions, mainly in the United States. These groups often have many observers located at different points north and south of the limit line. With the many timings made, often with sophisticated equipment, the actual profile of the moon can be drawn and compared to the theoretical profile. An example of such an effort is given in the March 1971 issue of Sky and Telescope. As a result of this discovery, all Gray's predictions are now automatically changed to allow for this shift. Anyway, these are some of the important steps in plotting a graze path. Even though we missed the graze, we should have sent our negative results to Mr. Dunham, as this might have been of some use in determining the outer limit to the moon's profile. An added plus was the good fellowship we enjoyed. On our next attempt, I made some other interesting mistakes. This was the graze of Eta Leonis on April 19, 1967. The sky was overcast all day, and I did not think it was worth trying to observe the graze. However, one member of my team talked me into going. Hugh McLean, Joe Hauser, a friend of mine, and I arrived at a spot near the Queenston power plant just as the sky was clearing. We set up the telescopes a few minutes before the time of the graze, and Hugh McLean made several good timings, which were reported to David Dunham. We saw an unusual event at one point when the star faded to a lower level of brightness, remained there for a second or two, and then blinked out. Dunham wrote and said that the Eta Leonis was probably a close double star previously unknown. He stated that such behavior had been observed at other grazes. It was a beautiful clear night during and after the graze that we stayed and enjoyed a mini star party. Our next adventure was on June 9, 1968, and the star was Antares. We set up in John Allen Park in the southern area of Niagara Falls, about 100 yards from the spot where the Niagara Falls Center had held public star nights. The hot day had finished with a warm, humid evening accompanied by many mosquitoes. Walter Scott was among the several members present, and Hugh McLean came at the last minute after arriving home from the General Assembly in Calgary. Although our telescopes would show Antares through the hazy atmosphere, we became concerned because Joe Hauser had not yet arrived with his radio and tape recorder. We had planned on using these to time the events. About 60 seconds before the first disappearance, I saw Antares start to vibrate. I looked around and there was Joe jarring the base of my telescope as he set up his equipment. He soon finished and we timed several events. The graze was spectacular and the whole experience was very exciting. At one of the disappearances, Walter Scott and I saw the star fade continuously for about 1 second. David Dunham said that his group had seen similar effects. He suspected that Antares had faded slowly because it has a relatively large angular diameter. I might mention that a ham radio operator with a mobile unit was there, and we were in contact with the expedition of the Toronto Center. Unfortunately, this group was clotted out. For this graze, I had borrowed a topographic map from the high school geography department. I inadvertently left it outside the car during the graze, and it became rather wet with dew. After it had dried, it was covered with various wrinkles and bumps and unsightly formations. I believe that I tried to correct this condition with limited success by means of a steam iron. Several months elapsed before I got around to returning it to the geography department. Fortunately, there was no one in the room when I arrived, so I left the map on a desk and departed quietly. Sometime later, the Niagara Falls Center bought the 1 to 25,000 scale topographic maps, which cover most of the Niagara Peninsula. These have been useful in several ways and are a definite asset to our center. They can be ordered at 50 cents each from the Department of Energy, Mines, and Resources, and they are also sold in bookstores. I should point out that we received predictions for more grazes than we observed. We did not attempt to observe some of them because their paths were too distant from Niagara Falls, or the stars were too faint, or conditions for observing were unfavorable. A few outings were canceled because of bad weather. Our next expedition was on October 24, 1970, around 2:15 a.m., and it took place on the property of a poultry processing plant. Hugh McLean and I had scouted the site several days before the graze. We had obtained permission from the owner of the plant to use his land, and we had carefully chosen the exact location for our telescopes. We had gained familiarity with the roads in the area and had informed the police of our intentions. The value of this planning became apparent on the night of the graze when we assembled at the Main Street Library at 1 a.m. in a dense fog. Since we knew exactly where we were going and did not face the task of exploring unfamiliar territory in the fog, we decided to go anyway. Sure enough, the fog cleared considerably after our telescopes had been set up. The moon finally rose above the thick fog and ground haze, appearing quite dim. Some time elapsed before the star was spotted. This was ZC-1449 of magnitude 6.7. The first disappearance was to occur on the bright limb, and although conditions continued to improve, the star seemed to meld into the bright lunar limb with no definite disappearance. However, Hugh McLean successfully timed the last reappearance, which took place on the dark limb. It is interesting to note that he signaled the event by squeezing a New Year's Eve party clicker. This was used because the reaction time of an observer using a hand-operated mechanism is considered to be more predictable than when he uses a verbal signal. After the graze, the sky became very clear with excellent seeing, and we had some exceptional views of Saturn, the Orion Nebula, and several star clusters. Well, I hope that this description of our experiences has been interesting and perhaps beneficial to those who may attempt such projects. Much useful and necessary information on occultations is contained in the literature available from David Dunham. There are also some interesting discussions of the scientific uses of graze observations, and I would advise anyone who wishes to observe grazes to contact David Dunham or John Howell. It has been a pleasure to have observed these few grazes. They are indeed spectacular phenomena and well worth a little inconvenience in arranging your attendance at a suitable place to observe them. Our advice then is to take a chance. Go to your selected place even when the weather is against you. It may clear just in time. It has happened to us.
Spots would greatly enhance the quality of the paper. I proofread his copy of degraded us somewhat in doing so, but that is the final copy that was read at the front. I would also like to mention that the topographic map, the original predictions, the lunar limb profile, and also the analysis done in England of the last great dimension, the one that we observed last October, are all in the Niagara Falls Center display. So if you want to see what a grade map looks like when it's flooded, and where our exact location was, and so forth and so on, just go and have a look at our display after the meeting or whenever you get a chance, and you'll see all that stuff there. Now, are there any questions? And I'll try my best to answer them, and if I can, I'll give them to the plans. Yes?
Are these predictions readily available?
All you have to do is write to David Dunham, and he'll give you all the literature. Between 50 and 100 pages of literature explaining all the steps you need to do, and they're absolutely free. All you have to do is just write for them. I think it's W.H. Warren in Indiana University, Indiana, that actually makes the computer predictions now. But I think you can start off by writing to David Dunham, and he'll send you all necessary information you need for these predictions, including all sorts of helpful hints on timing things and tremendous amount of useful information. That's all I need to do, is to write a letter to him, and he'll send you everything you need to know. It's like it might surprise you how much you get, actually. But it's very readable, and it's a very interesting thing to see. By the way, you'll have to fork out 50 cents each of the topographic maps, but it cost our society $8.50 to cover the entire Niagara Peninsula, the biggest scale map you can get. So it's worth the money, really. Does that answer your question all right? Any other questions?
Probably down to 100%. And these things are very useful for the questions.
Any more discussion? I think we'll have to bring this discussion to a close since time is getting on. Mr. Winder, I would have judged that from your vigorous discussion you could have delivered the paper after all. Thank you very much, and thank you also, Mr. Duran.